The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Nearly a year before Rachel Trelisa, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley disappeared, another tragic and terrible mystery befell Fort Worth. The February 17, 1974 abduction of Carla Walker, whose body was found 3.5 days later in a culvert near Bembrook Lake. Carla had been raped and strangled to death. The perpetrator of her sexual assault and murder, I guess I'm supposed to say allegedly since he hasn't yet seen trial, was then 31-year-old Glenn Samuel McCurley, but that wouldn't be known until DNA testing and genealogical research by Texas's own Othram Incorporated identified the McCurley surname in September of 2020. The man had been scrutinized in the initial investigation of Carla's rape and slaying, but evidence against him, at least evidence sufficient for an indictment, could not be found. McCurley was off scot-free to do God knows what for the next 46 years of his life. Since his 2020 arrest, many have speculated his potential involvement in the case of the Fort Worth missing trio. McCurley was a bold and brazen perpetrator, after all, ripping Carla from the arms of her boyfriend in his vehicle before putting a gun to his face and pulling the trigger. If the gun hadn't have jammed, there's a good chance Rodney McCoy would have died that night. The abduction was completely random, according to the Fort Worth police. McCurley was on the prowl, saw Carla Walker heading back to the car, presumably, after she used the restroom in the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley, and waited for the best possible moment to strike when Carla got back in the vehicle and she and Rodney began making out. The murderer and rapist, alleged murderer and rapist, probably could have found easier prey that night, but didn't. Now, I personally don't think McCurley was involved in the disappearances of Julie, Renee, and Rachel. But again, his arrest raised questions and brainstorming by a ton of us armchair detectives nonetheless. I know little about McCurley and his movements throughout the years, like much of the public who didn't know him. McCurley has remained in Fort Worth since he raped and killed Carla, was some type of truck driver, and strangely enough, possibly fits the description of the man seen at Seminary South with the trio on December 23, 1974, the day they went missing. He was tall and dark-headed. There is, however, one line of examination I've seen that I'd like to squash. In April of 2019, long before the name Glenn Samuel McCurley re-emerged in the Carla Walker case, the Fort Worth police released a letter, hoping someone in the public would recognize the handwriting. The letter writer said that a redacted name, or pronoun maybe, killed Carla, and this letter was sent to the captain of detectives, Oliver Ball, around the time of the murder. Since the letter's release, and especially since McCurley's arrest, folks have been making handwriting comparisons to it, and the letter claiming to be from Rachel Trelisa, discovered the day after the trio's disappearances, in an attempt to connect McCurley to the case. First of all, the handwriting on the letters isn't even close. Second, when asked at a September 2020 press conference if the Carla Walker letter was connected to McCurley, Fort Worth homicide and cold case detective Leah Wagner said, "Well, hear it for yourself."
Letter. Did that tie in at all?
No, it did not.
I'm certainly not trying to say that speculating Glenn Samuel McCurley's involvement in other Fort Worth rapes and murders is unfounded. To the contrary, I think he's most likely responsible for other crimes. The February 1973 murder of Becky Martin is, in fact, eerily similar to Carla's slaying. Though he is an interesting possibility in the disappearances of Renee, Julie, and Rachel, there's nothing out there at all that really suggests his involvement. It's easier and more comforting, perhaps, to think that just a few madmen roamed the streets of Fort Worth in 1974, committing a ton of heinous crimes each, than imagining there were a ton of madmen committing only a few depraved acts each. But the truth is, in Texas back then, and in Fort Worth, there were plenty of predators, rapists, and murderers, and at least a few have been considered in the case of the Fort Worth Missing Trio. Besides Lloyd Lee Welch Jr., whose involvement in the murder of the Lyon sisters in Maryland at this point is undeniable, there are two other sort of high-profile criminals that folks have speculated could be responsible for the disappearances of Rachel Trelisa, Julie Mosley, and Renee Wilson on December 23, 1974. We're not going to go into them in great detail because there is absolutely nothing solid that suggests either one of these individuals' involvement. However, that's not to say both of these killers aren't worthy of consideration. They certainly are. James Mitchell DeBartolieben, for one, has long been a topic of scrutinization by many while discussing the case of the Fort Worth Missing Trio. Known as the Mall Passer, DeBartolieben was nothing short of a prolific criminal, and the extent of his crimes will almost definitely never be known. The crimes in which many believe DeBartolieben got away with are terrible, unthinkable to anyone with a normally functioning brain. James Mitchell DeBartolieben was born in 1940, and his family moved around quite a bit over the course of his childhood, even once living in Germany, because his father was military. While living in Arlington, Virginia as a young adult, having moved in with his parents there after being released from prison in the spring of 1963, DeBartolieben took up a new hobby, nude photography, and the severity of his crimes seemed to have escalated after a series of illnesses left him not only ailing thereafter, but also, apparently, affected his physical appearance, something he thought highly of. In 1966, after a long stint of running a multi-state scam where he took money from elderly widows posing as a federal currency examiner, he and his third wife's cousin kidnapped and raped a young girl. Because the young girl went with the men of her own free will, however, a jury acquitted DeBartolieben and his accomplice of the charges later brought against them. I guess the system itself was teaching the man what he'd later tell his third wife, that women deserved whatever they got. DeBartolieben hated women. He is suspected in several sexual assaults and murders throughout his adult life. But perhaps it's best to back up a little. DeBartolieben was a criminal for the entirety of his free adult life. But signs of what was to come, some say, presented themselves in adolescent years, though his teenage activities paled in comparison to his adult crimes. Throughout his childhood, DeBartolieben was less than obedient, often resulting in the wrath of his hot-headed and abusive father, who would sometimes hold his head underwater to cool him off when his temper, which mirrored the old man's, was out of control. His mother was neglectful and an alcoholic. When his father was out of town, his mother would take the kids to the bar and spend nights out with strange men. In fact, she was said to be incredibly promiscuous and adulterous, but his father apparently was too, to be fair. When his mother was good and liquored up, it's been reported, she'd become physically abusive. I'd say this is likely what led to the development of DeBartolieben's hatred of women. According to his third wife, he considered all women sluts and whores, and if they were raped or beaten or worse, it's what they deserved. The fact that DeBartolieben was a middle child, perhaps, only exacerbated the feeling that he, especially, was neglected by his mother and singled out for behavioral issues by his father. Because both his sister and brother were obedient children, and DeBartolieben was rambunctious, I guess, his parents expected bad behavior without attempting to quell it, and negative reinforcement set into motion a self-fulfilling prophecy. At school, at least in the early years, DeBartolieben was bullied, only aggravating his issues at home. Still, though, none of it excuses the terrible crimes he'd later be suspected of, if he is indeed responsible, and by all indications, he likely is. Regardless of problems at home, DeBartolieben was an above-average student until around age 16. He was also a talented artist, a skill that would come in handy when he became a proficient counterfeiter. The best timeline for James Mitchell DeBartolieben's life can't be found in old newspaper archives and Google searches. Most of what follows here concerning the timeline is the result of the painstaking work of Stephen Michaud's book, Beyond Cruel. I can't recommend it enough if you're interested at an in-depth look at DeBartolieben, but we're just going to do a quick run through the man's life. He began threatening his parents and had a particularly strong hatred of his mother, who he is said to have physically assaulted when he was about 16. DeBartolieben was also first arrested at that age for carrying a concealed weapon. He was expelled from school in the spring of 1957 and enrolled in the Air Force after a judge made him a deal concerning the weapons charge and another hit to his rap sheet for reckless driving. "Join the military," the judge said, "and get a slap on the wrist for the charges." In the Air Force, DeBartolieben resisted and disrespected the authority of his superiors and was discharged just over a year after joining. A military psychiatrist had called his intelligence superior. However, he was unfit for the armed services due to a lack of conscience and antisocial tendencies. In August of 1958, DeBartolieben moved into his parents' home on Spurgeon Street in Fort Worth, Texas, in the city's South Hills neighborhood. And at this point, the folks' expectations, the self-fulfilling prophecy they'd made by labeling him an untamable problem child early on, not to mention the abuse and neglect, were really showing themselves. In fact, there are claims that his parents grew fearful of him. He'd punch holes in the wall at home, kick open, shut, or locked doors, set fires to things in his room. But if I had to guess, I'd say those fears manifested long before this time. DeBartolieben's parents couldn't punish him or even hold him accountable. They were no match for him anymore, and the abuse and neglect at their hands turned to restrained interactions and circumspect behavior around him. They feared making him angry, setting him off. DeBartolieben's criminal career, too, had hardly even started. If you're done binging that dark and riveting podcast you haven't been able to put down, and thinking of going down a rabbit hole to feed your already overwhelmed brain with every other tidbit you can find on the web, consider instead giving your noodle a rest with Best Fiends. If you're a regular listener, I'm sure you know by now how much I love Best Fiends, the challenging puzzle game I play when I need a break from writing, recording, or editing to get my mind out of the dark places. Apparently, I need a break often since I'm on level 2800. I clear a few levels here and there too when boredom has me antsy or on a coffee break at the dreaded and robotic day job. Best Fiends has it all. Bright colors, a rad little army of bugs and other small creatures you can collect, and it's totally casual. It allows me a break from the mundanities of the everyday routine and the sometimes overwhelming dark places that producing a true crime podcast takes me. Try Best Fiends for yourself. The puzzle game already has over 5,000 challenges, and new puzzles, events, and challenges are added all the time. With over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. In October 1959, with no intentions of holding down a 9-to-5 job, James Mitchell DeBartolieben began committing a series of crimes, from botched gas station robberies to successful auto thefts. In fact, and interestingly, considering Rusty Arnold's attempts at locating a specific car in the body of water starting in 2018, DeBarta Lieben was arrested and convicted in one of those two auto thefts, one of which the then 19-year-old submerged in Benbrook Lake. That conviction landed him 5 years probation. The following year, his probation for auto theft was revoked, and DeBarta Lieben was sent to prison in Huntsville. After release to his parents 8 months later, they'd since moved to Arlington, Virginia, DeBarta Lieben's threats against his parents were worse than ever. He'd threatened his mother with weapons, once a hatchet, and after several occurrences was sent to a state psychiatric facility. At least part of the issue DeBarta Lieben had with his parents involved the fact that they'd been strongly against two of the then 21-year-old's newest hobbies, nude photography and pornography. Now, those hobbies can be relatively harmless on their own, or at least outwardly, but upon DeBarta Lieben's marriage to his third wife, a 19-year-old cosmetology student, it became remarkably less so. Concerning the man's nude photography, his third wife was kind of an unwilling participant. It seems like she wasn't really keen on the idea, but began letting him take nude photos of her just so he'd stop asking. The nude photographs turned to photographs of the two having sex, in which DeBarta Lieben would tie up and cause his third wife pain during the acts. It wasn't long after he began extorting his wife with those photographs, telling her he'd reveal them to her family if she didn't help him with the federal currency investigator scam, the one where he'd steal substantial amounts of money from widows and the elderly. It wasn't only that, though. He never beat his third wife, but she was more than aware of his disdain for women. DeBarta Lieben told her of his fantasies of raping, torturing, and strangling to death a woman, staring her in the eyes as life left her body. It's right after these scams in 1966 when DeBarta Lieben and his wife's cousin abducted and raped a young girl. In the following years, he and his wife masterminded and performed plenty of scams and criminal schemes, kidnapping for ransom among them. DeBarta Lieben was finally apprehended for the last time in Tennessee by Secret Service agents on May 25, 1983, after passing counterfeit $20 bills at malls in multiple states for years. But upon searching the man's various properties, his home, storage space, and car, authorities quickly became interested in him for far darker crimes than printing and passing funny money. Fake driver's licenses, stolen plates, hundreds of dollars in counterfeit bills, guns, and items suggesting he'd posed as a police officer were found not long after his arrest. But it was the sex toys, bindings, photographs, videos, and scripts he'd written depicting violent pornography that turned into the cops' biggest concern. The photographs and videos, in fact, sometimes depicted DeBarta Lieben hiding his face and sometimes not, leading investigators to theorize that he only hid his face in the ones where he knew he was going to let his victims go. If his face could be seen in the rape photo or video, they thought DeBarta Lieben killed the victim. James Mitchell DeBarta Lieben became the prime suspect in numerous sexual assaults and murders from Louisiana to Maryland and beyond. It's hard not to go on about DeBarta Lieben. He was a prolific and depraved criminal, and the scope of his acts will likely never be known, but it's Fort Worth we're interested in here. And Fort Worth in December of 1974, to be specific, when Renee Wilson, Julie Mosley, and Rachel Trelisa vanished. Because he became known as the Mall Passer for his counterfeiting operation, many have theorized that he could have been at Seminary South on the 23rd of that month and ran into the girls, posing as a security guard or cop to lure them in. That was indeed something he was identified as doing by survivors of the man's depraved sexual assaults, though usually he pulled them over while driving to do the whole cop thing. Either that, or he'd allegedly act like a potential homebuyer and rape, torture, and kill the realtor in the home she was showing. Likely, DeBarta Lieben was the person who did this to Jean McFall in 1982, just outside of Shreveport, Louisiana, and to Edna Terry McDonald in 1971 in Barrington, Rhode Island. Anyway, I've seen claims that DeBarta Lieben was in Fort Worth in December of 1974 when Julie, Renee, and Rachel disappeared. But for the life of me, I can't find an inkling of proof that he was anywhere near the area. Not even property records make his whereabouts clear, and he used false identities so much, it's difficult to imagine we'll ever know where DeBarta Lieben was on December 23, 1974. He doesn't even appear to have begun passing fake money at malls specifically anyway until the late 1970s, making the Seminary South connection kind of a stretch. It is clear, however, that the man was in Tarrant County in August of 1974, settling up the estate of his mother, who died the previous September. After his 1983 arrest, DeBarta Lieben was given a total of 375 years for various crimes, from counterfeiting to kidnapping. Authorities were never able to stick him with murder charges, though he remains the prime suspect in around 40 homicide cases. James Mitchell DeBarta Lieben died while incarcerated in 2011, likely taking secrets with him that would provide answers for families of victims across the country. Like Rodney Alcala or the Dating Game Killer, authorities have a collection of photographs and video of unidentified women that DeBarta Lieben may have raped and tortured, or even murdered. I'm not certain why they haven't released the media on a wider scale to try to identify the women in them, but I do know that because of the nature of DeBarta Lieben's crimes, the counterfeiting convictions specifically, the Secret Service is in command of the evidence they collected against him. This has created at least some difficulty in bringing up further charges against him for law enforcement jurisdictions that suspect DeBarta Lieben and unsolved crimes they have. Rachel Trelease's brother, Rusty Arnold, was involved in a search of the Spurgeon Street house that was once home to DeBarta Lieben. Nothing was found, and Rusty insists that DeBarta Lieben has been ruled out. If it's only for the search of his parents' Fort Worth home, however, I'm not so sure he's been ruled out at all. But then again, no evidence exists that suggests he was involved in the disappearances of Julie, Renee, and Rachel. Either way, DeBarta Lieben has been written into the Fort Worth missing trio mythology, as has another demented human being, one whose confessed crimes seem a closer fit to Fort Worth's missing girls than DeBarta Lieben's. A guy who'd confessed to what he called the 11 who went to heaven. We covered the creep we're about to talk about in an earlier episode of ours back in April of 2019, titled The Death of Surfer Girls Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson. But we're going to go over the man again here instead of just recommending that y'all go back and listen to that. On Thursday, August 24, 1978, a man named Edward Harold Bell stopped his red pickup truck on a Pasadena, Texas street where some children were playing. He exited the vehicle wearing no pants, only a red shirt, and began masturbating in front of them. A woman in the house directly in front of where this was taking place saw the half-naked man approach the boys and called police. Her son, 26-year-old oil-filled roughneck Larry Dean Dickens, overheard his mother's call to the cops and, naturally, was pissed off. Larry quickly burst from the home and confronted Bell, but not before removing the keys from the pervert's truck so he couldn't flee. Bell became irate, demanding Larry return the keys, but the young man wasn't letting up. Larry wanted to be sure the cops got him. Bell retrieved his blue jeans from the truck and put them on. The pants weren't the only thing he grabbed. Bell now carried a .22 caliber gun, which he fired in the air as he demanded the keys. Still, Larry wouldn't give them to the man. Bell lowered the weapon, pointed it at Larry, and fired several rounds into his body. Larry retreated to the garage of the home and stumbled into a clothes dryer, holding on to the machine to stay upright. He was bleeding profusely, but he still had this creep's keys. Bell followed him, entered the garage, aimed his gun at Larry's head, and retrieved the keys. He shot Larry in the head anyway, jumped in his truck, and sped off. As he drove away, a responding officer saw the truck, recognized it as fitting the description that had been called in, and pursued Bell. Not knowing the neighborhood well, apparently, Bell turned into a cul-de-sac, drove into a yard, and fled on foot. But Bell stopped when the pursuing officer fired his pistol into the air and demanded it. He was arrested and charged with indecency and the murder of Larry Dickens, who died a hero before the paramedics arrived. At the bail hearing, the state argued that the man's bond should be high since Bell had assets, and the judge set it at $125,000. But Bell paid 30% of that easily to a bail bondsman the following day. Edward Harold Bell cashed out his bank accounts and other holdings and skipped country long before his trial date the following January. For nearly 15 years, Bell was a ghost. He was the Texas Department of Safety's most wanted fugitive, but they failed time and time again to locate him. That is, until late 1992, when the television show Unsolved Mysteries aired the case and a tip from Panama City, Panama came in. Larry Dickens in the Unsolved Mysteries episode, by the way, is played by Texas's own Matthew McConaughey in one of his first roles. Anyway, Texas Rangers arranged for Panama City police to detain Bell, and he was extradited back to the United States to stand trial in Texas. Edward Harold Bell, then 55 years old, was convicted of Larry Dean Dickens' murder and sentenced to 70 years in prison. While incarcerated in a Texas prison, either Bell's conscience got to him or he just needed something to occupy his sick mind. I was kidding about the conscience thing. The guy didn't have one. Bell began writing letters to Galveston County and Harris County District Attorney's offices confessing to unsolved murders. He began with the November 1971 murders of 15-year-old Debbie Catherine Ackerman and 16-year-old Maria Talbot Johnson. The two were last seen alive on the 15th of that month, just before they set out to a Galveston mall to buy Maria's boyfriend a birthday present. Their bodies were found 2 days later in a Texas City bayou. Both teenagers had been shot to death. Again, we did an episode on Maria and Debbie's slayings back in April of 2019, if you'd like far greater detail. As a side note, it's a tragic story. To get back on track, Edward Harold Bell ultimately confessed to a total of 11 murders after beginning a back and forth with journalist Lisa Olson. He claimed in his confessions to have been brainwashed, tortured, and mind controlled by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I'm assuming he's thinking of the CIA's MKUltra program, but FDR is a little early for that, so who knows. It's all nonsense anyway. It was simply Bell's attempt at lessening the blame on himself, making him the actual victim. It's pathetic, but he was pathetic and a known con man, not to mention rapist and pedophile from way back. His record for such sexually motivated crimes going back to 1969. Anyway, Bell ends up confessing to the murders of several young women and girls, calling them the 11 that went to heaven. It's unclear exactly how or why suspicion of Edward Harold Bell in the disappearances of Rachel Trelisa, Julie Mosley, and Renee Wilson came to be, but I've got some ideas. Although I can't find any telltale proof of big activity by Bell in or near Fort Worth, there are some strange connections that could lead to eerie speculation. Bell confessed to the murder of Colette Wilson, who disappeared from Alvin, Texas in 1971 and was found 5 months later near a Houston reservoir. Edward Harold Bell also confessed to the 1974 murders of Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear, whose bones were found just outside Alvin in a Brazoria County oil field. For years after the remains were found, in 1976, and before they were finally identified in 1981, And until it was made clear that only two sets of bones were found, not three, it was speculated that the bones belonged to Renee Wilson, Julie Mosley, and Rachel Trelisa. Interestingly, and you may remember this from part three of our series on the missing trio, John Swaim said of other remains they searched for in Port Lavaca, Texas, quote,
"I'd say that we've got one of two things. Either the girls have met with foul play and are down there, or somebody else has been killed and someone wants them found."
Now, again, he was speaking here about the Port Lavaca bones and not the Brazoria County bones. But perhaps Edward Harold Bell was orchestrating a search for the bodies of some of his victims and called in the tips himself concerning the three girls' remains. Or perhaps Bell was involved in the disappearances of the Fort Worth missing trio. Either way, he died in a Texas prison in April of 2019 at 82 years old without ever confessing to any involvement. We've been over a lot of information in this case. It's difficult, at least for me, to hold any one theory about what happened to Rachel, Renee, and Julie concerning who is responsible. There's no evidence at all that Edward Harold Bell or James Mitchell DeBartolieben were involved, no more than there's evidence that Lloyd Lee Welch, William Ted Wilhoit, or Billy Simpson were involved. Some aspects of Renee, Rachel, and Julie's disappearances make it look like the work of an opportunistic predator. But perhaps there are even more signs that suggest whatever happened was at the hands of someone at least one of the girls knew, and probably knew well. But there are certainly no shortage of persons of interest, whether in the eyes of armchair detectives or the Fort Worth police. The disappearances have impacted the families in ways that few understand. It nearly ruined Julie Mosley's mother, Rayanne's, life, I've been told. It drew clear divisions between members of Rachel's family, the Arnolds, something that continues to this day. Rachel's husband, Tommy Trelisa, has also had to live with the burden of being considered guilty by a ton of folks. There have been claims that many members of his family have gotten death threats over the years. Though Renee Wilson's father, Richard Wilson, generally keeps to himself about the case, he spent the last 46 years looking for the truth, as did his wife Judy before she passed. His breadth of knowledge about the case is a clear indication that it has consumed him, regardless of the stoicism I've seen and heard while speaking with him. One thing is absolutely certain. The case has become a hot-button topic for virtually everyone who becomes interested in it and follows the many rabbit holes there are. Concerning the missing trio, I've seen some of the ugliest exchanges I've ever witnessed while researching an unsolved mystery. I've seen lies and mistruths go on and on, continually perpetuated by people close to the case and the press. These things have been seemingly unchecked and unquestioned for years, just taken at face value. It's insane. Members of all three girls' families say they've dealt with the ugliness too, and the lies and the mistruths, and it's gotten worse as the years went on. Rusty Arnold, Rachel's brother, is the only family member I have recorded talking about it.
It's gotten savage. When you get to where you start looking over your shoulders, telling your kids and your wife and your family and the other families, that you start looking over the shoulders. These families grieve every day. And recently they've been put through stuff. They've been put through stuff I won't even mention that they should not be put through. It goes all the way back to the beginning. You know, we had girls, little girls calling the house saying that, you know, calling Renee's dad, Richard and Judy, you know, saying they were the girls, and, you know, we caught them. They got caught. We tapped the phones and caught them. They were just making stuff up, you know, acting like they were the girls calling. And it was, you know, it's little stuff like that for 40 years, 44 years.
It's been a struggle trying to figure out how to end this story. Of course, we deal in unresolved cases, so there never is a real ending with any episodes we do. But the case of the Fort Worth missing trio is especially perplexing. The case is particularly mysterious considering the lack of evidence and the unnecessary confusion that has become woven in over the course of the past 46 years. I don't know what happened to Rachel, Julie, and Renee. I don't even have an idea. After attempting to sort through the mess that's been made of this case, I'm even farther in the dark than ever before. I also know that what is most often forgotten while accusations are being hurled and names are being called is what this whole thing is all about. The missing girls, Julie, Renee, and Rachel. They are what matters here. I'll just leave it at that. If you have any information about the disappearances of Mary Rachel Trelisa, Lisa Renee Wilson, and Julianne Mosley, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. We'd like to thank again Kelly Arnold, Sherry McReynolds, Kim Cadell, Judy Burns, Jana Roberts, Jackie Jones, Linda Trelisa, Tommy Trelisa, Janet Mosley Hensley, Wanda McCaslin, Terry Mosley, Mary Kay, Kim, Diane, and so many others. If you've helped us in any way, thank you so much. Special thanks to Rusty Arnold for his contribution to this episode. Again, we'll provide a link in the show notes to DNASolves.com, where you can go if you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or maybe help identify a Jane or John Doe. At DNASolves.com, you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. It means the world to us, and we couldn't do this without you. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Dallas Morning News, the Washington Post, and Stephen Michaud's book, Beyond Cruel, were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.